This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
The Rich Zeoli Show podcast is sponsored by Mike Venaria Jr. with Osperity Private Wealth.
Hi, I'm Mike Venaria Jr., wealth management specialist. Make your retirement dreams a reality by creating your retirement plan today. Call me at 856-252-0107.
So young men are making a comeback in Trump's America. Free to be guys again? Free to be alpha males? Are alphas back? Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here today. 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Zeoli. And should Derek Chauvin get a pardon from President Trump? These are all the issues we're going to talk about this half hour with our wonderful guest. It is our happy hour brought to you by the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. You should book your Memorial Day plans now. And don't forget, they have their big family spring break splash package. Just go to grandhotelcapemay.com and look at all the details. He's the man himself. He's Dr. Wilfred Riley, author of the book Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, and he joins us now on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD. Dr. Wilfred Riley, first question for you today is, now that the president has said we want to shut down the Department of Education, how will this change all the lies that our liberal teachers are telling us?
Well, I don't really know if that's necessarily going to do anything. I mean, when I talk as an educator about the Department of Education to parents, if you talk to Moms for Liberty or something like that, something on the center, people generally think the Department of Education runs schools or it has some actual role in the schools. I mean, that's not really the case at all. What the Department of Education does is administer all the standardized tests that your kids have to take. They are responsible for the different curricula that go into the schools, ethnic studies, LGBT, that kind of thing. So I guess in the sense that the school standards will now be set by the states, and so Montana or Mississippi, for that matter, which has a mostly African-American but right-leaning state-level school board, I mean, so on down the line, they're not gonna keep the same policies in place that the Dept Ed did. So I mean, I think you'll see different policies in the schools, but a lot of what getting rid of the Department of Education would do is just get rid of purely formal paperwork. I mean, does every state still take the NAEP exam in eighth grade, for example? That's the kind of thing the Department of Education supervises.
And are these exams, are they important for kids? Are they a waste of time for kids? I mean, if they're dictated on the national level, it makes me think that's probably not the best thing, because probably states would be better left to figure out when tests should be taken and what those standards should be. But that's me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's mostly true. I mean, I think a way to think of this is kind of like vaccines. So, I mean, I initially was really mocking of kind of like the mom's anti-vaccine movement, just like sitting on a golf course, like, hey, you want polio back? But, I mean, then I actually looked at the vaccine schedule. It's not just measles. It's like, I think there are 86 vaccines. A mother or someone in the audience might correct me. But there are 86 vaccines that you take before you're two in the United States. We give kids vaccinations for things like HPV, which is an orally sexually transmitted disease that really you would hope that young children are at no risk of catching. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, you want basic health. The question is all of that necessary, or is there, you know, a little bit of financial interest from the doctors and the hospitals there? And that's also how I feel about standardized tests. I think you should take the SAT to go to college. You know, I think in eighth grade, maybe again in 11th grade, you should take a test to compare America with China, all that. You know, the seventh and sixth grade, the PSAT, all that, I think you could probably scrap that without too many consequences. But again, the Department of Education, they don't run the schools. They administer those tests. Like, they collate the PSAT results year over year, state by state, race by race, that kind of thing.
Let's talk about Black Lives Matter Plaza, which was a thing, sure. Apparently. A lot of people may not know this, but they were going to erect this in D.C. after George Floyd's death. Now it is being removed. I don't know if they ever actually finished the completion of this. I don't know what the waste of the taxpayer money was on all this. But what the hell was this Black Lives Matter Plaza anyway?
Well, actually, I went to Black Lives Matter Plaza because you couldn't not. If you were going down the 16th Street kind of bar strip and souvenir store strip, and my fiance wanted to look at a couple things, Black Lives Matter Plaza was just the fact that the words Black Lives Matter had been painted down the middle of that street. So the street itself was painted black, and in bright gold you had these 16-foot letters that said BLM, Black Lives Matter. And apparently it took eight artists a couple of days to do this. So the artists would come out at night, they would shut down the street, and I don't know whether some of them were there for spell checking or whatever, but they would just paint Black Lives Matter. And so this two-block area was covered with this almost graffiti-level art. There are the faces of famous African-American figures kind of vaguely visible on the sides, but it's mostly just the big gold and black painting. And President Trump decided to get rid of that. I think the D.C. Council agreed with him. So I guess they're just painting it over. They might be blacktopping or something, but they're gonna cover that up, and it's just going to be a road again, pretty much.
Well, did we need this in the first place? Or again, it seems like this was part of the reaction in America, the overreaction that happened that summer that then led America down this. I mean, we were probably already going down a woke road. I don't know. But it seems like that was where it all began. And maybe that was the kind of the Abbey Road of wokeism. I don't know. But and for years, it would just get worse and worse. But the grifters got very rich off this. As you pointed out in your tweet today, Dr. Wilfred Riley, Black Lives Matters, Marxist BLM founder racks up million-dollar property empire with at least four homes. $1.4 million for one, $415,000 for another home, $590,000 for another home, and $510,000 for another home. I mean, it seems to me like they took advantage of this, and they said, all right, well, America's going to go down this road. People are posting things on social media. Corporations are making statements. Now it's time to cash in.
Well, yeah, what I did was I asked the people on my Twitter page who are mostly kind of men in business between 25 and 45 to come up with synonyms for the letters BLM, and one of them was buy large mansions. And either I or someone on the page posted that famous New York Post cover where they simply have the founder of BLM, who's an avowed communist, posing in front of all of her houses. And I think at one point she had seven. So there is an element of humor here in terms of the classic question for a rebel leader, like where Robert Mugabe had $15 billion in Swiss bank accounts and was regularly spotted eating dinner with these, you know, very upper class, very, you know, melanin deprived global leaders in Europe. Like, is there really a belief in the cause, or was the goal like making your family generationally wealthy? You could ask that about Colors. But yeah, the point you were making about George Floyd, I think, is actually a really important point, because before that, you'd seen kind of the left and the right go back and forth on this. Like, are we going to do 2 years of just hard woke and see how it works? So you'd seen an attempt to exploit Michael Brown. You'd seen an attempt to kind of make Trayvon Martin into a hero. And that really vanished at the trial, where it really just emerged. This was two guys that got into a fight. Martin doubled back and began the fight. You've seen a couple of these other people, Freddie Gray, put forward. And finally, they got what seemed like the perfect martyr in George Floyd, where you had this image of the cop with his knee on the neck of this innocent black man, choking him to death. And before anyone could really investigate that, it became a national symbol. Posters were printed, and people started responding hysterically. Like, you had the gold coffin drawn by a team of horses. You had the Democrats kneeling in kente cloth in the Capitol Rotunda. And so we did get defund the police for a year and a half. We got an op-ed in the New York Times saying, yes, we mean literally abolish the police, that this stuff shouldn't be forgotten. And, you know, later it turned out, like, no story is perfect. Like, George Floyd very likely overdosed on fentanyl.
Right.
You know, I mean, for my next book, I've read the coroner's reports. They're, all of them are now publicly available. One thing, last thing on this, the fentanyl amount listed in the first coroner's report is actually wrong. Floyd was sampled before his death, I believe, and the standard procedure, and I remember this from law school, is to sample like 36 hours later when the concentration will have increased, will have solidified. Matt Walsh pointed this out. And it turns out that later, if you go into this obscure paperwork, this was done, and the already high concentration of fentanyl had increased by about 500%. So, like, it's very, very likely, yes, that was an overdose death. But at first, that wasn't apparent. And so you had this killer cop scenario that became one of the most divisive stories in really American history.
Yeah. And so now we're at this place, right, where we're talking about, what do we do with this officer who has been sentenced to, is it life in prison, Derek Chauvin?
I believe it's something. It will in practice be life. Yeah, he's a cop in a tough federal prison. He's already been attacked twice. Yeah, it's like 40 years.
All right. And, you know, Ben Shapiro came out, your buddy, and said President Trump should pardon him. And it started a big conversation on this. It certainly seems like, from the perspective of that would be the correct thing to do justice wise. It certainly seems as if this officer is paying a societal price more than he's paying a price for what he personally did. You know, it's just society said, we got to punish this guy. We need to get our pound of flesh here. But he himself did not kill George Floyd. So that's an injustice in my mind. Politically speaking, I don't know if Trump cares or not. I don't know if this would be a smart thing for him to do. Politically speaking, I don't know. But I'm glad the question's out there, because I don't think anyone should be in prison for something that they are not directly, that they didn't do. And then he's in jail for killing this man, and he didn't kill him.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of levels here. And this is an interesting case for me, because I actually don't like real police brutality at all. I mean,
no,
I'm from
me
a black
neither.
And Irish background in Chicago. Yeah, no, very similar. I mean, from a large city as well. So that, I think everyone had an initial impression of this. And I mean, even now, I don't think anyone thinks this was ideal policing. But yeah, like, we've all seen the documents now, and kind of like educated politically wired in America, and they are what they are. So there are a couple levels to it. Like, first, I think it's impossible to say Derek Chauvin got a fair trial. Like, even if you're in that 30-40% of the right that still thinks, okay, maybe this was kind of a justified sentence. He didn't exactly help this guy who was obviously fishing out, who was obviously dying. You know, it's extremely rare. In fact, I'll say it normally would be impossible, as someone with a legal background, for someone to be sentenced for murder 2, murder 3, and manslaughter. Those are different crimes. So, in fact, those have different standards of intent. Like, that's impossible. So what you had was a situation where you had mobs. In fact, you had people from both sides, but mostly on the left, outside the courthouse, chanting people's names, chanting about George Floyd, like, while the jury was deliberating. And everybody knew that if Chauvin were acquitted, or even if he were found guilty of manslaughter, which is arguably the right decision, like, the city would be on fire again. There'd
right.
be a massive riot. This time the guard might be sent in to put it down. Hundreds of people would probably die. So Derek Chauvin was kind of the sacrificial lamb that was thrown out into the fire to prevent that. I think most people in the law know that. And if you read, like, law review articles between the lines, that's very often said. So, I mean, when you look at, like, should he get an appeal? Should he get a retrial? Should he get pardoned? I mean, probably. I'll just say that. The other thing to remember is that, like, all the cops that were involved in this went to prison. So there were three or four other officers on the scene. There was a black guy. There was a Cambodian guy. Two of these guys are decorated veterans. The other cop on the scene was a rookie. He was on like his seventh day. None of them really did anything to George Floyd. They were actually busy holding back an angry mob. Mm-hmm. And all of them, I think, got at least 2 years. So there's the question of, like, what do you do? Do you pardon all of these people? How do you resolve a case that was so obviously politicized like this? The problem with the George Floyd thing, though, realistically, last sentence, is that even if you pardon him, he doesn't get out of prison. Because the federal count is only like 1/4 of his sentence. He was convicted in state court. Right. So you would just sort of say, well, you're pardoned. Like that would be the pardon would be delivered to his jail cell and then he would stay there. You know, like that's what would happen.
Yeah. And that's a piece of this, too, that I think is really important to note. And again, I was, you know, when I first read that, I thought, well, I didn't even realize that there were federal charges involved here, which is a whole other problem, too, because now you're dealing with double jeopardy. And I always think that it certainly defeats the spirit of the double jeopardy clause of the Constitution. If the states and the Fed can both go after you, or one can go after you after you've been acquitted. And then, you know, I have a problem with that, but that's obviously for another show. But yeah, so it would be a symbolic gesture. So then President Trump, I mean, I think doesn't seem to care if people are angry at him. He would probably have more support for doing so just for the symbolic value, but it doesn't change anything. So then the problem then becomes, does it then give fire and fuel to the left to just scream racism, 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 which then hurts the next Republican who runs in 2028. Now they have to, do they denounce this? And then, so you know, if you can't change the state of this man, in other words, he's going to be in prison regardless, is it worth then having this political fight for just simply making a point that could blow up in your face down the road?
I'm not sure it is. I mean, on a purely moral basis, and that's probably one of the first times, thinking back to law firms and trading floors and so on, I've used that sentence. But on a purely moral basis, it's probably a good idea to pardon Chauvin. In practical terms, I do think there are some questions. Like, by the way, what you mentioned is actually really important when you get into these race cases, because obviously most people have this idea of congressional and statutory double jeopardy. You can't be charged twice for the same crime. Mm-hmm. But you can be charged in two separate cases for very similar crimes. So when you look at these cases like Ahmaud Arbery, you know, for that matter, to pick a black guy, O.J. Simpson, anything that's high profile and interracial, what you very often get is a state charge on murder or something like that. And then on the off chance you're acquitted, a federal charge on some kind of obscure civil rights violation. Like Darren Wilson, the guy who shot Michael Brown, and that was a totally justified shoot. There's none of these debates. I mean, a guy who'd been recruited as a community college football player reached into his car and grabbed his gun. But he went to court, I believe, 3 times. And finally, even the Obama Justice Department said, okay, no, you're innocent. But that's how you do that. You charge at the state level, you charge at the federal level, you allow one appeal, so on. But anyway, I mean, like, if Derek Chauvin, you know, if you actually pardon him, I mean, like, one practical question is, does he then go back to state prison from federal prison? That's even worse. Like, oh, you got pardoned now, huh? You know, like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that in practice would be good to be a police officer inmate who's received some legal benefits. So I would encourage Trump to kind of put together a team and, you know, see the pluses and minuses, decide on it. That would be my suggestion, really.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating and complicated case. No question about it in terms of the all over it. That's why I wanted to chat with you about it, because you are an attorney in addition to obviously being a professor and a political scientist. And that's Dr. Wilfred Riley, my guest right now.
One other thing there?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to bust in, but I mean, Trump, actually, at the leadership level, one thing that I might do that I believe the president can do, if not a, you know, Attorney General could do it, governors might be able to do it. But I would look at what could be done with Chauvin. Like, is it possible to transfer him to a minimum security prison where he'd be in a safe situation and he can, you know, write his memoirs or whatever, mm-hmm. while you look at the case and you see down the road, is it going to be possible to free him as opposed to keeping him in, I'd assume right now he's in a max or a super max. I'd have to look at the details. But, like, there are things you could do for him where you're keeping him away from potentially violent inmates, and for that matter, where you're keeping some, you know, young black radical guy away from this cop who's obviously well trained to fight, and you're potentially saving people from harm while you decide what to do with the case. Like, I would try to make him as comfortable as possible if he's in that scapegoat role for a little bit.
Well, so that's a really fascinating point too, which is his own personal safety, right? Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't even think about that because, you know, now you put him in state prison. It's like, oh, okay. You know, everybody talks about wanting to be in the country club prisons of the federal level. Now you're like, you're going to state. I mean, I shouldn't laugh about it, but I mean, that would be kind of like, gee, thanks for the pardon. You know, I got to worry now about getting shivved in the shower, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, where'd this happen? Floyd was Minneapolis. Yeah, you'd be going to Minnesota State Prison. That's about half Nazis and half Somalis. I mean, I don't mean to be glib about it, but yeah, like, that's not a good environment. So what I would do with Chauvin is look, are there safer federal prisons where there aren't a lot of racial tensions, where you're talking about, you have like mafia rats, you have FBI traitors, Islamic terrorists who are at the fundraising level. You know, I mean, it sounds awkward to break it down so specifically, but that's where you would put someone who is in a very high profile, you know, fighting man kills someone, cop or soldier case. And, you know, maybe 5 years later, you can revisit all this. There's a Republican governor in that state, and you can then get him out. But those are the kind of things I would be thinking about right now.
Dr. Wilfred Riley is with us. It's great to have him here today. I appreciate him being here with us. Let's talk about young men, since you said your Twitter audience is a lot of young men. There was a story I read that my friend Caroline Downey wrote about how young men are making a comeback now. Like, it's okay to be a guy again, you know, an alpha male again. And this is a good thing, I think, too. But particularly for that generation, because she's Gen Z. And shameless plug, I was on Fox News with her today, so we shared a panel. We were chatting in, you know, in the hallway after this, and you know, she's married, and so she's not in the dating world. But I mean, that generation, it's been a little tricky for younger people. And I don't know, I think young men, for a while it seemed as if we were going to lose any chance of maybe reproducing as a population for a while there. But maybe young men are now making a comeback and deciding, hey, dating's a good thing, women are cool, and maybe this whole marriage thing's not bad either. So that gives me hope.
Yeah, me too. Now, one thing I will say, I think young men were kind of bamboozled. I think a lot of young men took feminism first and then the manosphere backlash. Like, guys tend to be kind of blunt pack animals. And I think a lot of people took a lot of nonsense seriously. Like, well, things that young women are saying must be verbatim true. And I don't mean to mock that, but that may not always be the case. Like, if you look at the revealed preferences of women, bosses, so on, like, you know, we like men that are, you know, moderately dominant, make money, stay fit. I don't really feel that much has changed for the past 100 years, except that there's a preference guys be a bit less sexist, which I think is good. Mm-hmm. You know, but so men who went the normal route, you know, play sports in high school, go to college, maybe join some kind of Greek organization, maybe join the military instead of college, get out, work in sales or law or something like that. Every guy I know that did that is in a happy marriage. So I do think that there were a lot of these sort of temptations that were set up for guys, gambling, extreme amounts of pornography, all this stuff, the feminist message about how to be a man, that were never intended to be taken fully seriously, that a lot of guys really internalized. And then there were sort of these guys that said, this was the manosphere. People came along and said, well, that stuff's all crap. Now here's what you should do instead, be a pimp. And a lot of guys took that really seriously. And if you just ignored all of it and went to the gym, you would have been fine. And I think that you're now seeing more people, whether you're talking about, you know, Jordan Peterson, Peter Boghossian, martial arts senseis, that whole like ex-Navy SEAL sector, including my buddy Brooks Crenshaw. Like, you're seeing more guys just say that, which I think is good. But last thing, like, yeah, having very male role models like Trump and Vance and Cash Patel and all those guys in the White House and having them occasionally record messages for men and so on. Yes, I think that's good. And let's hope they say positive stuff, you know, but I think they will.
Let me ask you this question too while I have you, because it's always fun chatting with you about nonsense. Is what's relevant in culture these days, you think? I was thinking about this the other day watching Shane Gillis host Saturday Night Live, but I didn't watch him host Saturday Night Live live on Saturday night. I watched clips of him the next day as people were sending clips. I thought he did a great job. It was very funny. There was even a skit, I don't know if you saw this or not, where they were doing the news. It was like two white reporters and two black reporters. They were like, that one's on us, that one's on us. And I don't know, it was edgy and funny, and I just haven't seen a skit like that in a long time. And then I started thinking about all these online comedians that a lot of people probably have never heard of, but have like massive followings, and they're funny people. They're not household names necessarily, right? And you know, they're not Sebastian Maniscalco names, but they're huge followers. Like, where is culture right now in terms of who's influencing things? Because obviously the Democrat Party cannot figure this out, and they can't get their act together with any of this. And that cringy video they put out with the Street Fighter thing was just, you know, I mean, laughable. But like they always say, politics is downstream of culture. So where's our culture right now? Where are our influencers, and how's this whole thing playing out, you think?
Well, I mean, so yeah, Street Fighter was the, you know, sixth most popular game of 1998. Like Mortal Kombat was way better. So I mean, I don't get that one at all. Like it's important never, even at my age, it's important never to try to be cool by bringing up the symbols of your childhood. It's like people saying groovy. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And that's why I like the adult gentleman's uniform of like Brooks Brothers blazer in my jeans, a polo, brand polo shirt. Like that hasn't changed for like 100 years.
Yeah.
You stop trying to be cool. Like, if I wore like a Megadeth shirt or something right now, it would be the opposite of cool, you know, like, so are Tupac. But anyway, although I see kids wear both now, like in a retro sense, and I'll ask them, like, what's your favorite Pac song? And they're like, what? Who's that? Anyway, but moving on, I actually think there are two trends in culture, though. One is that at the top level, because of stultification and because of wokeness, very little has changed. So I was reading Complex, the men's magazine, the other day. The number one black African-American subculture is hip-hop. Number one white subculture is hipster. Except maybe for metal, this would have been the same when I was in high school, or at least college. You know, the number one comedy show on television is SNL. So there's an incredible just stability, stasis. It's really weird. It's as though you'd gone to college in the 1990s and you'd seen people walking around in full-on hippie gear, like granny glasses or in zoot suits. I think that a secondary element of that is that there obviously is real youth culture, but it's mostly online, yeah. And a lot of the online cats have far larger followings than the people in the mainstream. Like when they canceled Joy Reid's show and they revealed that her audience was 54,000 people, I don't mean to boast about this, but like my Twitter following is 150,000, and many of them follow daily.
Right.
So it's
the numbers on this show are bigger. We're a local radio show.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Like, yes, you or I could talk to more people every day than Joy Reid. Joy Reid had a 30-person staff, like $10 million budget. If they gave you or I or anyone else in that kind of secondary sphere that amount of money, the show would be top 10, 20 on television, Fox or whatever. But anyway, I think so. That's a very important point. But again, I think that for whatever reason, political correctness or just not knowing what it is, a lot of that culture that's under the surface, and that would include conservative talk, that would include the edgy internet, that would include the local comics, that just goes unnoticed. And just one example, I was in the gym the other day, and I was working out with these sort of younger conservative Appalachian kids who are also kind of hip-hop. And they were playing all these quote-unquote MAGA rappers, and I was like, this is going to really suck, no offense. But they were actually really good. There's a whole bunch of them, like Bezbelieve, Forgiato Blow, the Marine Rapper. Like, they're all these people that are, like, conservative, working-class, mostly white guys. And you just realize, listening to them, like, none of these people are going to get a record deal, but if you look up Bezbelieve on YouTube, you see every video, you know, 7 million views or something like that.
I mean, I don't know that person because I've literally never heard that name before, but that's the point I'm making. It's like, that's crazy to me, and I don't know, I feel as if from my perspective, being behind a microphone in a traditional radio, and then you see, you know, some person sends me a tweet from somebody who's got like 5 million followers on X, and he's doing political commentary for 3 minutes a day, probably winds up making more money than I do when it's all said and done. I'm like, how does this person have such a strong following? I'm on the radio every day. This is what I don't get, and I'm not sure we're going to crack the code here today, the two of us, but that whole thing just blows my mind. I guess that's all I can say. I really am just making a commentary on it, but not anything else, really. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's just new platforms. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I do think that the thing that's notable is the refusal of the people that control the old platforms to open them up.
Bingo.
So, like, when I looked at, like, the working class white MAGA rappers, many of whom were from Appalachia, FJ Outlaw, like, all these people, there were like a dozen of them, Rocky Luciano. It was just sort of like you looked at all of them and they were like these politically inappropriate, poor, mostly Caucasian kids. And again, you just knew like they're not bringing this guy into a business meeting. And maybe they should. Like, I don't see a reason they wouldn't. Well, I mean, I see like 4 reasons they wouldn't, but they're all like race and class prejudice. So, you know, overcome that.
I mean, first of all, MAGA rapper, there's a lot of people listening right now going, did they just say MAGA rapper?
Yeah, Google B-E-Z-Z. Believe, like B-E-L-I-E-V-E. There are literally dozens of these cats, and they are not bad. There's a Savannah Dexter is an attractive Appalachian girl who's a MAGA rapper. There are literally dozens of them. It's an entire subculture of, like, working-class hip-hop kids.
I love hot MAGA rappers, hot MAGA rapper chicks. I'll take that all day long, Alex. But so then the other thing becomes the comedians, and there are these, I guess you'd say MAGA comedians. I don't know. I mean, they lean right in their political commentary. Some of them are completely offensive, and I love it. Like Andrew Schultz is a great example of this.
Yeah.
These huge followings that these guys have, and a lot of times their stuff is so edgy, it probably can't be on a traditional platform, I guess, but maybe it would not be, if we had not gone down that woke road we talked about back in 2020, maybe all these MAGA comedians would never have emerged because it wouldn't have been so shocking to the system to see people who are like brave enough to make like black jokes in the year 2024 and 2025.
Well, it's an interesting insight into what's rebellious. Like, I mean, so in the 1990s, there was actually a joke, like in my scene of friends, like what could shock a Chicago raver girl? And the implication was, can anyone come up with anything chemical or sexual or artistic that could? And no one ever could. But I mean, now you realize like what actually could, like joking about Hitler or something. Not that that's always good, but you now realize like, okay, so the kids with the hippie and raver parents have figured out the one way to rebel. Like, it's really awkward to say this, but like mom's done everything else. So what do you, how do you show that you're a rebellious dissident? Like, you vote Republican, you cut your hair, you wear a clean, well-washed polo shirt that you iron. Like, it's absolutely hilarious. But if you look at the Proud Boys, they're like a bunch of varsity football players that know how to fight, are multiracial, and wear, you know, like, ironed-down polo shirts. And
yeah,
that is considered, like, so rebellious that it's almost against the law. So you get rebellion is just 180 degrees from the norm. If the norm is the HR lady instead of the Southern sheriff becomes ultimate rebellion.
That's an excellent observation, my friend. That's why we love having you on the show. All right, great. So you're working on the next book. When are we thinking timeline wise? Because we actually got to pull off an event this time since we were not able to do it last time.
Yeah, I'm still more than available for that next time I'm out on the coast. The book is new to your audience. If I bring
well,
out a crayon.
Well, let's do it. I mean, DeSantis, if you can get, speaking of people that don't have resources, you mentioned Joy Reid, all these people. I got DeSantis. It's like Pophead Jenko. I got, you know what I mean, from The Godfather. DeSantis, can we make this book event happen or what?
I would love to make it happen. You know, it was a personal goal of mine. We got to get Stalker on board, and yeah, I see no reason why it can't come together.
All right, so get us some dates. You're going to be on the East Coast, so let's just do this for people would love to see you and meet you. You can come to the Grand Hotel at Cape May and hang out with us. That's a fun place.
That's probably it. That's probably how something like that would actually happen. I don't know whatever happened with the publisher, but we will certainly do that. I mean, I didn't afford a plane ticket, but the next book is called Confidently Wrong, and this book is interesting. It's a little wonky, like all my books, but it actually is important because it looks at what's going on with climate and what went on with COVID in kind of the same dry, like somewhat witty P.J. O'Rourke style, but with real numbers. And the question is, like, why are all these expert predictions wrong?
Yeah.
So, like, we shut down because a specific guy, Neil Ferguson, said 3 million people were going to die before October of 2020. Like, that's a real thing that happened. Why was he wrong? Like, I actually know why he's wrong, and I can tell you without being excruciatingly boring, but I go from there to, like, 100 other things, like the Western heterosexual AIDS crisis that never happened, you know, peak oils 1 through 8 that screwed up your investments, the population bomb where that fool said everyone in India was going to die. You know, just, like, why has none of the global cooling, front cover of Time, why has none of this stuff ever happened? What is the narrative behind the world ending when it never does? And there are a bunch of things that go in there, from residual communism to just neuroticism, the feminization, if you will, of society and so on. So I talk about it a little bit. That's the next book.
You got to do the PragerU book club. They invited me out there next month. Michael Knowles hosts that, you know, and they asked me to come out. So I'm flying out there next month. We went through back and forth about which book I should choose to talk about. And we ultimately settled on Animal Farm by George Orwell.
That's a good book.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of went back and forth, and then they gave me a list. I gave them my top three. I went Animal Farm, Fahrenheit 451, and 1776. And they said, we wanted to do Animal Farm. We haven't gotten to it. Let's do that. Because, I mean, really, in the context of Orwell, 1984 really does overshadow that book. But there's a lot of great lessons in that book, besides just the fact that, you know, all pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others. I mean, there's a lot to that that you could say we're still kind of fighting that Marxism, Stalinism that Orwell was always trying to fight against.
Yeah, well, I actually think Brave New World in particular, but also Animal Farm, are more accurate than 1984. 1984 is kind of the projection of sort of Hitlerite dictatorship into the future, where it's a boot stomping on a face forever.
Yep.
Whereas the other books are kind of more subtle, like the beings from within your own group slowly become something else when they get power. And it takes you a long while to realize they're never going to give up any of their power, and they're becoming just like the old lords. And that's a really funny take on communism and anarchy and so on, because the whole idea of, like, the dictatorship of the proletariat, right, is, like, you have one group of people. You can call them the first class in society. And the leaders of the second class, the generals, the student leaders, the union leaders, take power from the first class. And the idea of communism isn't that they're supposed to bleep and keep it. It's, which is what's always happened. That's where it stopped. Like, that's the only thing that's ever happened. Like, the union leaders and such then make themselves, like, the Comintern or whatever. But the idea is that these people are then supposed to design a perfect society, give up all their power and wealth, and share everything equally. And at the end of Animal Farm, you realize that's not going to occur, and the pigs start looking real human and carrying weapons. And they trained the dogs to fight for them, right? That was another thing that happened?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, so that's just a hilarious. It's not exactly subtle either.
You know,
the dogs or the soldiers. It's a little offensive, but I mean, that's a description of what actually happened when the second class took power and just trained their own warriors. So I mean, again, Brave New World is even more accurate. It's just sort of the idea that you don't need to use. There's certainly a steel fist in the glove, but you don't even really need to use brutal power to manipulate people most of the time. You can use sexuality and all these crazy technologies. They have smell-o-vision, which would be interesting in modern American, you know, sex and blood movies. But they have, you know, all this sort of stuff. Everyone's on drugs all the time. Everyone's on Soma, which is a real drug, by the way. It's an antidepressant that makes you happy. We sell it. You know, so that's a thing that happened.
Wait, Soma? That's a real thing?
Yeah, the drug, for those who don't know, they're listening in the audience, Soma is a drug in Brave New World that everyone in the upper middle class takes. It's an antidepressant that makes you relaxed and happy and sexual. Soma is also a drug that's sold by, I believe, Pfizer. It's an antidepressant that makes you relaxed and happy and sexual.
Gosh.
And I personally think someone on the design team, probably a female graduate student, just had a sense of humor. Google Soma, S-O-M-A.
Wow. That's good. Originally I was going to talk to you about the Oscars when they stand up there and they go, we want to recognize the Chinny Chihuahua people in the land. And, and then they move on with the night because Bill Maher teed off on them the other night about that. But I thought it was great. Have you been on his show? We're way over, but have you ever been on his show real time?
No, we've talked about it once. And it did came close. It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a lot of things. There are a lot of people that are in like that top 5,000 reasonably famous witty guys who own a suit. If I was a little less to the right, cause I basically just say what I think. I'm not really like recalcitrant former Democrat or anything. Like actually I'm a conservative businessman. I'd probably get booked a little more, but no, it's never happened. I like Bill Maher. The most likely thing for me with him would actually be getting booked into like his pseudo nightclub show.
His podcast too, where he smokes pot and stuff, right? Like in the middle of while he's doing it with his guests,
Yeah, that's Club Random. That's actually what I'm talking about. No, actually, I've been like more about health. Like, I need to lose like 40 pounds. I've been like drinking way less and all that. So I don't really know if I'd want to go like party in California for 2 days. But if the numbers looked right, I probably would do it. But yeah, that's the thing where he's had people. He has a club in his basement. Basically, that's what Club Random is. He's designed one of those man caves, which has a 60 bottle bar and he's got one of those weed bars, I guess. So he's got what you'd see in a dispensary. They're like 14 different strains of cannabis and all that stuff, because he's always been a big weed head as opposed to bourbon and that kind of thing.
Well, I'll tell you, we'll have to chat more next time. I appreciate it. This was fun. We blew the clock out, but who cares? Dr. Wilfred Riley, get the book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. We'll catch up again, my friend, hopefully very soon. Maybe we'll just do it again on Friday, because I don't know. We still got to talk about Newsom and all this other stuff. So I don't know. Maybe we'll get you. Maybe if you can do twice this week, that could be epic. We'll talk about
it. Sure can, yeah.
All right, cool.
All right.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Talk to you, brother. Bye.
It's the 5 o'clock happy hour on the Rich Zeoli Show. Brought to you by the Oceanfront Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. A premier full-service resort and conference center. GrandHotelCapeMay.com.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. We sometimes just go, and then next thing you know, you look up and you go, wow, we're 10 minutes over. But I do want to thank the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey, for sponsoring that happy hour. I think getting Dr. Riley there would be a freaking awesome idea. So let's see if we can make that happen. That would be huge. And what else? What am I doing here, DeSantis? What do I got to do? I've forgotten.
For the love of God, go to break.
Just go to break?
Yes.
Like right now?
You should have went to break 11 minutes ago. We're so far behind. We have so many commercials we have to play.
So you said I should go to break?
Yes, I'm begging you.
But should I mention that I was on Fox News today again, or just go right to break?
I think the audience gets it.
Fine. We'll go to break. We'll come right
back.
Don't go away.
Thank you so much.
It's the least I could do.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so I went way too long with that last segment. That's okay. I think sometimes long conversations, long form interviews, I don't know, it's just fun. We don't do them often on the show. Radio is not structured that way because of the way that they do ratings, but I frankly don't care. I just want to give you good content. I don't worry about that stuff. I worry about giving you good content. That's always the way I look at it. And there's never a plan. We just go with our gut on these things. So, but there'll be more of that stuff coming up this week, because we have some great interviews lined up this week, actually. which is going to be fun. And I'm happy we didn't have to break into any Oval Office signings today. That was refreshing too. Not that I don't love hearing from the president, of course, but there's been so much to get to, and we do thankfully have another hour ahead of us, which is good, because otherwise we'd never be able to get it all in. The other point too that I wanted to mention is Josh Shapiro, this freaking guy, another cringe video he just put out. This time it's him sitting there with his face, and it's totally visual, and it just says, me thinking about when people want to ban abortion, and it's the AC/DC song Thunderstruck playing over that. Well, he just sits there looking up, and it's just, it's freaking cringy and weird, and I don't know. Maybe he'll get flagged like we get flagged whenever we play Thunderstruck, Justin, so, you know, maybe there's some hope there, I guess.
Yeah.
It's possible, right?
Yeah.
So, all right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back, though. We got more to get to. The war on Elon Musk is intensifying big time. People are calling Tesla's hate mobiles. That's the big story of the hour, brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Vanaria, VanariaDental.com. Go see him today for your perfect smile. VanariaDental, VanariaDental.com. The war on Elon Musk. Who led this massive cyber attack against X today? Who's behind it? Why did they do it? And is it foreign or domestic? Is it a country? Is it a group of people? These are the questions that we all need to know. We're going to try to get to the bottom of it. Maybe you were affected by it today. If you were, let me know. We're streaming live on YouTube. Join the fun if you haven't. We're having a party here online. It's a great time. I'm coming right back.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I saw that guy today at Fox News. He gave me my jacket back. That was good. But anyway, welcome back. I'm going to get into the whole reality TV bride thing with the groom at the altar in the next hour, too. That's amazing. And the question I'll have for you is this a fugazi or is this real? Because apparently this bride dumped the groom because he wasn't aware of Black Lives Matter and stuff. So I got the audio of that. I don't watch these dumb shows, these reality shows. I don't. I escape. Whatever. If I'm watching television or a movie, it's to escape reality, is not to watch it. I can tell you that. But I don't know if this is a fugazi. My Zeoli fugazi radar is up on this. So I'll play it for you, and then you can decide what it is. The new Secret Service director was just sworn in a few moments ago. He's the man that you saw at Butler, who was holding his fist up in the air. And he's now the Secret Service Director of the United States, who's sworn in by Kristi Noem, the Director of Homeland Security, because Secret Service, as you know, is now part of Homeland Security, and it's no longer with Treasury Department as part of the restructuring of the after 9/11. So, yeah, Sean Curran is his name. He could be seen in that famous iconic picture at Butler. So he is now officially sworn in as the Secret Service Director. The other thing, too, is Elon Musk, the cyber attack. A few minutes ago, he said a lot of the IP addresses appear to come from Ukraine. That doesn't mean that it was Ukraine, obviously. And I don't know if I think it would be, considering that Elon Musk has given them Starlink. So, I mean, there's already people spouting off that they know exactly what happened. And you know my rule on this stuff. I'd rather be 4 days late to the party and right than the first guy out there with a theory and wrong. So I'll give you my take on what I think could be happening. But I think it's bigger than just a cyber attack on X. I think it has to just do with the anti-Musk derangement syndrome that's going on and that. So, I see what you're saying. For tomorrow, Matt, you're saying. Okay, gotcha. All right. Yeah, so, okay. For tomorrow's interviews, you're saying the Zoom link. But gotcha.
Right. We have a lot going on tomorrow.
Yeah, we do. I have four interviews to do tomorrow. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Although two of them during the show, though. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
We've been trying to record some interviews before the show so we don't bump any guests in case there's breaking news. So we're trying to do some of that. And then I got a Newsmax hit tomorrow at 11:30. So fun times, good times. All I got to do between now and then is not fall. I did fall down the stairs over the weekend, too. Did I tell you that? No, I did, for real. I swear, I'm not
How
joking.
Bad was it? Wait, so you fell twice?
Yeah, I fell. I went up the stairs. I fell down the stairs. Now, I caught myself, though, on the railing, thank God, because I saw my life flash before my eyes because my scooter was at the end of the staircase, and I grabbed it, and I just saw myself tumbling down. you know, headfirst into the washing machine, which is right behind the scooter. And I thought, oh, man, this is it. This is how it ends, you know, right? Like 2 days before my birthday. But no, I saved my life. Yeah, like I wonder. I thought, statistically, how many people die on their birthday? I wonder that too. But so then I fell off the scooter last night. I wasn't drinking or anything. I just tripped over something and then I went flying and then landed on my knee. So it's been quite a weekend. How I'm here, I don't know. I really don't know. It's a miracle. I'm telling you.
Just wrap yourself in bubble wrap or something. This is a disaster.
I don't think bubble wrap's going to do it. I think we need it. I'm going to have to be like, what are those guys that, with the coat of arms for the knights? Of, you know what I mean? Like, you know those outfits?
You want like a knight's gear?
Yeah, I think it's like that. All right, listen, we got, we're that to the Grand Hotel. The Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey, my happy place. You got to make your reservation for their spring splash package they have with the kids. It's great, okay? So please do that today by going to grandhotelcapemay.com. The more you stay, the more you save. And each of the packages includes breakfast. The kids will love the indoor heated pool. And it's a great time spring break to get to Cape May. The weather's beautiful. The crowds have not come back yet, and you'll love it there. So please make sure you do that. Go to grandhotelcapemay.com. It's never too early to book for Memorial Day, and summer's right around the corner too. What I love about the Grand Hotel is a huge outdoor heated pool, huge indoor heated pool, game room for the kids, restaurant, and so much more. So make that spring break splash package reservation today, and the kids will thank you, and your sanity will thank you. GrandHotelCapeMay.com.
The Rich Zeoli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD.